This is Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you on WPTF, AM 680, and WPTF.com. Joined by Mary Lucas from Transitions Life Care, here's your host, Jason Kong.
Welcome to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 92.9, 107.5, and AM 680, WPTF News Talk Traffic. Good afternoon to you. Jason Kong here with Mary Lucas and Carson Sellers of Transitions Life Care. Mary, how are you doing today?
Good. I'm back after a little hiatus, but feeling good, refreshed. The holidays, it's cold. We survived some winter storm, whatever that is in Raleigh. I don't know what it was.
You know, when you're not here, things just tend to go crazy in the world.
So I know.
Balance has been restored. Carson, yeah, right. How are you doing?
Doing well, thank you.
Good, good. Well, we've got a great show lined up today. We're getting back to our roots a little bit. We've got a Hospice 101 show prepared. And this, we feel, is always important because there is so much misinformation and myths that tend to be associated with hospice. So we always feel it's necessary to make sure that people have a good and accurate view of what hospice is and also what it isn't. And to help us with this conversation, we are very excited to have on the program today Dr. Emily Carlisle. She is a hospice physician with Transitions Life Care. Dr. Carlisle, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
Maybe we can start, Dr. Carlisle, so people can get to know you a little bit and a little bit more about your role. How about you introduce yourself and a little bit about how you got started in hospice care? It's such an interesting field to work in, and we all love it, obviously. But how did you get started in hospice care?
So I actually was an emergency physician in Maryland for about 11 years. And I love being an ER doc, but after a while, sometimes we do a lot of wonderful things in emergency medicine, but sometimes you do wonder, are we doing things, two people instead of four people? Mm-hmm. And, I'd have a patient come in and I'd realize, I'm admitting this patient to the ICU for the third time in 2 months. And, this is somebody with a feeding tube, they can't talk. I'm kind of wondering, is this actually what this person wants me to be doing? Mm-hmm. And so in the back of my head, I'm thinking, somebody needs to have a conversation, with this person's family. And then after a while, I was thinking, maybe I should be the someone. So I decided to do a hospice and palliative care fellowship, which I did in 2018. And I was in Tennessee for that. And then my husband and I are from the Carolinas, and after fellowship, we had the opportunity to come back to the Triangle, which we jumped at, and that's when I started working for Transitions. I was actually part of the palliative care team. We're working in the Wake Med system, and then in the last couple of years, I've started working exclusively in hospice.
That's a great journey. I hear this from our nurses that work at Transitions often, people coming from the ICU setting or from emergency or critical care of some sort, about how it just changed their perspective on healthcare, how we're treating our patients, et cetera. So very interesting journey you had there. I think it's a great feeder into my next question, and this is going to be a hard one. Because I feel like it's such a expansive service, but how would you explain hospice care in an elevator pitch and how it kind of differs from other medical care like curative treatments, et cetera?
Sure. So when somebody has a serious illness that is in its end stages, which to some extent end stages are going to be different depending on the illness, but Medicare defines it as in 6 months or less if the natural progression continues, then hospice and the patient is desiring of a comfort-directed plan of care. So this is, generally means not going back and forth to the hospital, not wanting to do medications that are focused on the disease and interventions that are focused on the disease rather than their symptoms and their comfort. So you've got the two things that are, one, medical eligibility for hospice, and two, goals that are compatible with hospice, then hospice is an option.
Absolutely. Piggybacking off that, some people think hospice care is only for cancer patients. Can you clarify the range of conditions that hospice serves?
Sure. It's really any medical condition that, with its natural course, we expect, you know, to be 6 months or less. And obviously, that's not something that's perfectly predictable, because we do have some folks that are on hospice for longer than 6 months, and sometimes people are only on hospice for, you know, a few days. But it's really any condition. So cancer is certainly a common reason for people seeking hospice care. A lot of cardiac conditions, so heart failure, heart disease, COPD, and other respiratory conditions are common. Dementia is another common dementia, all types of dementia, so vascular dementia, Alzheimer's in the late stages. Mm-hmm. Folks come on to hospice when they're desiring comfort-directed care.
I want to dive in a little bit more there, especially with things like dementia and heart failure, as you mentioned. Those can be quite long prognoses for someone. Mm-hmm. Is there an ideal time for someone to come on hospice care? I know my grandfather had heart failure, and I mean, he had it for mm-hmm. years. And so it's not mm-hmm. necessarily immediately terminal. What is the, and same with dementia, my grandmother had it for 7 years. We worked with her for seven mm-hmm. years before she passed. What is the optimal time, or when it does it turn beneficial, at what stage of a serious illness for someone to enter hospice?
So for, Medicare has guidelines for different disease processes. Not everybody who comes onto hospice has Medicare, but I would say the vast majority do. So we're looking at, since most people have Medicare for their insurance, that, we're having to follow the Medicare rules, just like the rest of healthcare. Usually we're looking for hallmarks of end-stage disease. So for patients with heart failure, that might be somebody who has severe shortness of breath just at rest. Often those patients are using supplemental oxygen most, if not all the time. Or they have other severe complications of heart failure, like their heart squeeze is so minimal, they're only doing their heart squeezes only a fraction of what it's supposed to with every pump, or they're having serious life-threatening cardiac rhythms. And so those are hallmarks that we look at. With dementia, it's usually late stages of dementia. So these are patients who often are, they're frequently having trouble speaking at all, or if they speak, it's just a few words. They're generally having, a lot of the things that we see, or they're having trouble swallowing, so they're at risk from getting a pneumonia from having their food go down the wrong pipe, mm-hmm. Which is another life-threatening complication. And so we're looking at those end-stage diseases. Sometimes patients do come to us not strictly speaking on those end stages, but there may be something else going on, like, they have dementia and now they have a new diagnosis of, say breast cancer. And it may be the breast cancer may be early. It might be the breast cancer by itself doesn't have a 6 month prognosis, or the dementia by itself doesn't have a 6 month prognosis. But when you start combining these two things, then you're looking at a shorter time frame than you would with just one or the other.
We are speaking with Dr. Emily Carlisle. She is a hospice physician with Transitions Life Care, and we're talking about hospice care, what it is. We've got a Hospice 101 show that we're doing today and going over some common myths and frequently asked questions related to hospice. And we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Carlisle right after this. Don't go anywhere. You are listening to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 92.9, 107.5, and AM 680. WPTF News, Talk, Traffic.
This is Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you on WPTF, AM 680, and WPTF.com with your hosts, Mary Lucas and Jason Kong.
Welcome back to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 92.9, 107.5, and AM 680, WPTF, news, talk, traffic. Hey, if you want to learn more about Transitions Life Care, be sure to go online to transitionslifecare.org, transitionslifecare.org. There are just so many resources available online for you. It is just great, great, helpful information, transitionslifecare.org. Speaking of great and helpful information, we are very excited to have on the show today Dr. Emily Carlisle. She is a hospice physician with Transitions Life Care, and we are talking to her on the line in the studio. It is Mary Lucas and Carson Sellers. I'm Jason Kong here, and we are talking about all things related to hospice. And Carson, in the first segment, we kind of went over what hospice is, what it isn't, who it's for. And now we've got some more time with Dr. Carlisle, so let's get back to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So you dove into a little bit of your background and what you do for Transitions, but just getting into some more specifics. How do you collaborate with other members of the hospice care team, such as nurses, social workers, and chaplains?
Yeah, so hospice, as you mentioned, hospice is definitely a team-based approach, taking care of the whole patient and their family. So the hospice team consists of a nurse case manager. Typically, this is the same person who knows the patient, knows the family, knows the meds. Going to be making those hospice visits every week, and they know the symptoms best. They know the meds. If they're seeing changes in symptoms, then that nurse is typically reaching out to either me, the hospice physician, or the hospice nurse practitioner, so that we can get a better hold on symptom management. Also, part of the team for patients and families who desire it are a hospice social worker, who wears so many hats. It's kind of hard for me to begin to describe all of them, but they do. They are providing emotional support. They're also providing a lot of logistical support. Social workers are great problem solvers. And so sometimes they may be helping with a range of things like getting facilitating a handicap placard for the car, or helping provide some resources for getting more help in the home. There's also a hospice spiritual care counselor for folks who feel that they would benefit from that. That's not necessarily just for patients who identify as part of a specific religious organization. A lot of times folks on hospice are just, they're having, they're thinking about things in terms of, either what comes next, or just, putting, reflecting on their life and, the meaning that they've had in life. And spiritual care counselors are just, great, great people for a conversation. So that's kind of the whole team that is helping take care of the patient. Typically, my role is either helping with specific symptom management, and usually that is medications. Sometimes it's other interventions, like somebody with, a lot of fluid on their stomach from a liver tumor might, get some of that fluid drawn off, but ordering, ordering that sort of thing. And then there's some, my other role kind of falls into administrative things, like signing things that have to be signed by the doctor, and also making sure that certain documents are in order, just to document the reasons for somebody being on hospice.
That's really helpful. We hear all the time on my end, which is very beginning stages of coming onto hospice. My team meets with families and patients in the field and at nursing homes and with doctor's offices, et cetera. And the questions can range quite dramatically. What are some of the most common things that you get as a hospice physician from families who are considering hospice care, or maybe even who have just come on and been admitted to hospice? Mm-hmm. What are some of the common questions you get as a hospice physician?
Sure. And I would also mention that sometimes I do, I am doing visits as well, sometimes mm-hmm. for complex symptom management or for If there are some goals of care that haven't been resolved, then I might go out and do visits as well. For as far as some of the questions, I think probably the biggest one that patients and families have is what is and isn't allowed on hospice. I think there's a lot of misconception even within the the medical professionals about. Some people think, oh, well, you go on hospice and you have to stop all of your medications. They only give you morphine. And that's not true. We continue a lot of medications. We are focused on symptom management and even things like, often we continue blood pressure medications because people often don't have specific symptoms with when their blood pressure is high, but they just feel bad. So we continue blood pressure medications. We continue nebulizer treatments like albuterol, things for asthma and COPD, certainly things for pain and anxiety. Those are, part of it as well, nausea. But we do actually continue a lot of medications. It's not just hospice is not like a faucet where we just shut everything off once you come onto hospice.
Absolutely. And we'll get into the medication part of it a little bit later because I think there are a lot of big misconceptions about that. But I know in your role, you have to have a lot of hard conversations with families and patients. What strategies do you use to help families cope with the realities of hospice and the eventual loss of their loved one?
Yeah, that's definitely something that is on families, minds as well. And I think some of it's, we do a lot of listening on hospice because it's easy to assume that what you think they're worried about, someone's not always worried about it. So a lot of it is listening and just being open to hearing about, what their concerns are. Sometimes it's practical concerns like, can they still see their regular doctor? Which the answer is yes. There may be some procedures that aren't continued on hospice, but you can still, if you've been seeing your cardiologist and you still feel well enough to go to get to the cardiologist's office, you can still continue to have, cardiology visits. Another thing that families are worried about sometimes, is hospice, giving up, which my view on that is that hospice is, it's not giving things up so much as shifting focus. So we, for most of the disease course, a lot of the focus is on the disease and we're treating things that affect the disease. And this is a shift towards treating the person. What are, a lot of our medications they're not guided by numbers. They're not guided by labs. They're guided by is this medication making you feel better? And that's the patient is our guide more so, than a lot of numbers and laboratory data. Something else that sometimes comes up for families is that patients, it's the natural part of life to eat less as you get closer to the end of it. For a variety of reasons. Sometimes it's that your disease makes it hard for you to eat. Sometimes it is simply that you don't have the appetite, and that's partly because your body understands a process for death, similarly the way your body understands a process for birth, and it's part of the normal state of things to want to eat less. Mm-hmm. And that's really, that's a shift that is hard for families. I grew up in the South. I did fellowship in the South, and food is love in the South.
So yes,
that can be a hard thing to understand. So some of the listening and just reminding families of that this is a shift. Also that taking in food is actually requires an energy to take in food and get energy from that. That requires energy. That requires a lot of. That can be actually taxing for somebody to take in food. And so keeping in mind that we're respecting what, the body is wise and we're respecting, what the body is telling us.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Emily Carlisle. She's a hospice physician with Transitions Life Care, and we're having an episode centered all around hospice care. It's our Hospice 101 show, and we've got more with Dr. Carlisle right after this. Stick around. You're listening to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 92.9, 107.5, and AM 680, WPTF, News, Talk, Traffic.
This is Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you on WPTF, AM 680, and WPTF.com. 60 minutes devoted to giving you all the information you need when caring for a loved one with Mary Lucas and Jason Kong. If you have questions for the show, you can email agingmatters@transitionslifecare.org.
You're listening to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 92.9, 107.5, and AM 680, WPTF, News, Talk, Traffic. Thank you for being here with us today. I'm Jason Kong here with Mary Lucas and Carson Sellers in the studio. On the line with us, we have Dr. Emily Carlisle. She's a hospice physician with Transitions Life Care, and we are talking about all things hospice. We've covered a lot of ground so far in the program. And Mary, one of the common questions or maybe misconceptions about hospice tends to center around medications. So let's focus some time there.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It's something that we hear a lot in the field and out in the work that we do. Dr. Carlisle, one of the first experiences someone has when coming on to hospice, there's many, and something that there's a lot of questions around is what we call a comfort pack or comfort medications mm-hmm. that are given to mm-hmm. a patient and their family right up front. Can you talk to us a little bit about what is included in a comfort pack and why that's given to people right up front?
Yes. So there are some symptoms that we want to make sure that we have the ability to improve, not necessarily immediately, because sometimes patients don't need these medicines immediately. But what we find is that with, you know, depending on what someone's disease process is, they could have a turn pretty quickly and develop symptoms quickly. And we want to make sure that, you know, we have something in the home to manage those symptoms. If it's something where we need to get someone out there, we don't want them waiting and having nothing for those symptoms. And so this includes pain, shortness of breath, anxiety, nausea, and the other one is constipation. And the reason for that is that sometimes the pain medicines can cause constipation, and also just not being able to move around a lot from generalized weakness, that can also contribute to constipation. So we want to, you know, be able to manage that. So the typical things in the comfort pack, concentrated liquid morphine, and the reason why we use this formulation is because you only need a tiny little bit and it can go under your tongue. So even if somebody is not swallowing very well, we have a way to manage pain and shortness of breath. Similarly, the medicine that we use for anxiety, which is typically lorazepam, that can also that pill can be crushed very easily and put under the tongue. We have a medication called Haldol, which is people who have some medical background may think of Haldol as an antipsychotic, which it is. But what we use it for in hospice more often is nausea, because it's actually a very effective anti-nausea medication. And we can, and again, we have a liquid form, and it's it can, you know, a small amount is effective. And so and then we have a few other things for nausea as well. But we like for folks to have the comfort pack because all of those medications are there. If these symptoms come up quickly, we, you know, they can call in, and a lot of times families will call into hospice and they're like, oh, they're having pain and they weren't having pain yesterday. You know, is it okay to give them morphine? And then they'll be talking to a nurse on the phone who can kind of guide them through the symptoms and guide them, you know, what to take from the comfort pack until we can get an on-call nurse out there if necessary.
Absolutely. That's very helpful. So using multiple medications can be a concern in end-of-life care, especially when coming on to hospice. How do you manage situations where a patient is already on multiple medications before entering hospice care?
So we go through those medications. We actually have a formal process of medication review because we want to make sure that we have all the correct information of what a patient is taking, because especially if their illness has been changing a lot, they may be getting a lot of medication changes recently. They may have recently been in the hospital and had some medication changes as they're coming out. So we want to make sure that we know what the patient is taking and what they're supposed to be taking. And then the second part of that process is also figuring out like what medications still make sense once someone is on hospice. So, you know, an example is, something like a statin, a cholesterol med. The statin pill that you take today, that's designed, you know, to prevent stroke and heart attack years from now. And so that's usually not that's not something that, you know, when you're talking on the time frame of hospice, that's usually not something that is providing a lot of benefit at this point. Another thing that, you know, we're looking at is, you know, things like a lot of folks are coming on to us because they have both reasons to be on a blood thinner and reasons not to be on a blood thinner. So they might have been at some point prescribed a blood thinner because they had a blood clot, or they had, you know, atrial fibrillation or a stroke or a cardiac stent, and they need to have a blood thinner to try not to have a clot. But then they may have also developed, you know, serious gastrointestinal bleeding, or they may have had falls or a brain bleed. Those are reasons not to be on a blood thinner. So part of it is the medicines that are a little bit tricky of, you know, should you be on this or not? We're doing a review to try to figure out, you know, what the best way forward is with that. And sometimes, you know, when we're deciding what we're covering, what we're not, we may be having a conversation, if not directly with the family, then through their nurse case manager, to figure out, you know, is this something we still want to be taking? And, you know, this is the stuff we're worried about. And so, you know, we're continuing, you know, the idea of shared decision-making even, you know, after, you know, somebody comes on hospice as far as medications go.
That's very helpful. I remember when my grandfather came on hospice and he was so worried because when you have heart failure, you're on all these medications, and if, you know, they drilled into him, you have to take the medications, you have to do it. And then he comes onto hospice, and I remember the admission, I was sitting there with one of our admission nurses when he was being admitted, and he was like, "Oh, no, you're not going to stop that medication." And I was like, no, we are. We have to. And he was like, he lost it. And he was just like, "No, I have to stay." And he did not understand. And then we paused for a second. I was like, "Grandpa, you have like 5 bottles of that in your closet. Like, you you can go ahead and continue taking it if you really want to. You have tons of it. We don't need to worry too much." So I feel like in some cases, while someone doesn't quite understand why they need to stop taking it, if you have a little bit on hand, you can still take it to kind of get you over the hump.
We pretty much never tell anybody they're not allowed to take medication.
Right, right.
We may say that, you know, we don't cover, you know, this cholesterol medication on hospice, but if you just got your 90-day supply and you want to continue taking it, like, we're not going to tell you you're not allowed to take it.
Exactly.
There may be some medications that people decide to, you know, that they want to keep taking, and, you know, they pay out of pocket. A hospice is paying, you know, might be paying for most of the rest of their medications, but they have 1 or 2 medications that they, they still want to continue to take out of pocket. And sometimes, you know, people love their vitamin D. so they may continue to take some vitamins. We will advise somebody, like, if we think that you shouldn't be taking a medication because it's actually dangerous, like, we'll have a conversation, you know, with you about that.
Absolutely. It's very helpful, especially for those who are kind of hold up on that part. I think that there's a lot of confusion around opioids and hospice care for pain, but also I don't think it's quite understood other uses of why things like, why do we use morphine for not just pain? Can you talk to us a little bit about some of the challenges around opioids in hospice care and how you address concerns with patients or families around using opioids at end of life?
Sure. So a lot of times folks are, especially in you know, the media, we've been hearing a lot, especially like the last 5 or 10 years, about the opioid epidemic. And so people are, you know, appropriately concerned about the side effects of opioids and, you know, are they going to be harmed, you know, by opioids? And what I would say is, you know, for, you know, morphine and its cousins, if you're using them as prescribed and they're under the care of a qualified practitioner, then you know, I don't worry a whole lot about misuse of opioids the way, you know, you worry about, you know, people getting pills from, you know, either getting things on the street where you don't really know what's in them, or getting them from, you know, these disreputable clinics where no one's really paying attention. They're just kind of handing out the prescriptions, because hospice physicians and nurse practitioners are trained to prescribe opioids appropriately. They're not without risk, but we're trained to assess those risks and also to try to minimize them. So we're, you know, we're looking at how often someone's taking them. Sometimes we might recommend a long-acting opioid. And part of the reason for that is to avoid some of these side effects, which may seem a little bit counterintuitive, but when somebody, you know, is having pain and they wait a long time to take any opioids, and sometimes they're taking extra to kind of catch up that, you know, from that symptom, we call it, you know, trying to get out from behind the eight ball. And using a long acting opioid, we can actually smooth out those peaks and valleys, and sometimes even use less opioid to get the same symptom control, because we're able, you know, to plan ahead and predict, you know, what the patient needs for those symptoms.
We're speaking with Dr. Emily Carlisle. She's a hospice physician with Transitions Life Care. And we're talking about all things related to hospice. And we're going to continue our conversation right after this. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 92.9, 107.5, and AM 680, WPTF, News, Talk, Traffic.
This is Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you on WPTF, AM 680, and WPTF.com. Joined by Mary Lucas from Transitions Life Care, here's your host, Jason Kong.
This is Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 92.9, 107.5, and AM 680, WPTF, News, Talk, Traffic. Thanks for being here with us. Jason Kong here with Mary Lucas and Carson Sellers here in the studio. On the line with us, we are very pleased to have Dr. Emily Carlisle. She is a hospice physician with Transitions Life Care, and we have spent the program doing a hospice 101 style show, going over, you know, everything that there is that you need to know about hospice, what it is, what it isn't. And Mary, we've got, thankfully, one more segment here with Dr. Carlisle, because she has been so gracious with her time. Let's make the most of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to address different levels of hospice care. There are a few of them, and talk a little bit more about some of the other levels of hospice care. What a lot of people don't know is that most people that are on hospice are at home, wherever they call home, whether that be their personal home, a family member's home, their loved one's home, assisted living, a skilled nursing facility, an independent living, wherever you call home is where most of hospice patients are receiving care. But something unique and a differentiator for Transitions Life Care is we do have our hospice home, and that is where a whole nother level of care is provided. And I want to touch on it because it is unique to us. It is not unique to the hospice benefit. It is part of your benefit when you are on hospice. So, Dr. Carlisle, let's talk about when a patient is no longer manageable at home. When do you assess someone to move up a level? What are there certain indicators you're looking for to say, hey, I think that maybe we should start talking about inpatient care?
Sure. And that's a great question. And that's something that often doesn't get talked about a lot before patients come on to hospice. So as you mentioned, the vast majority of patients are living somewhere that's not a medical facility, or if it's a medical facility, it's like a long-term care facility. And then they're receiving hospice, which is the medical portion of their care. And Medicare is paying for that medical care that, you know, they're getting in their home. So the nursing visits and equipment like hospital beds and meds and all of those things coming to their house. But sometimes we reach a point where patients were not able to control symptoms in the home setting. And that can be for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it's that patients are having trouble swallowing and we're not able to get, you know, we can't get the meds into them, or if they swallow, if, you know, if they're having problems with absorbing medications, you know, through their gut, then, you know, they're swallowing the medicines, but they're not getting the effect of the medicine. Sometimes their symptoms are becoming quickly, they're escalating quickly, and that we can't keep up with them with the oral route, or they may have a blockage and, you know, they can't keep anything down. Other things that may arise, sometimes patients, you know, may be having intractable seizures that, you know, we can't, you know, get a whole handle of in the home. And so, in those cases, we would have a discussion about transferring, the patient to the hospice home, if there's a hospice home bed, and if that's something that patients want. Cause I will say that sometimes, you know, with my team, I've got patients who are in a gray area where I say, hey, look, we've really been trying to get a hold of this symptom for, you know, a couple of days. It's reasonable to say, hey, let's try something, you know, that's IV or IM, and let's not keep trying to, you know, do this at home if you want to go to the hospice home. But I may have patients that say, no, I really, really want to stay at home until the very end. And so, you know, we kind of, you know, pull out everything in our toolbox that we can to try to keep them at home if that's what they want.
Right, absolutely. So talking about some of those indicators going further, general inpatient care, what is that? And what exactly is provided at the hospice home when you are kind of taken up to this level of care?
So general inpatient care actually doesn't have any additional out-of-pocket cost to patients or family members. The hospice home is kind of like the hospital for patients on hospice, where we're doing things that we can't accomplish in the home setting. And I think one thing to keep in mind about this, because a lot of times people wind up at the hospice home and they're like, oh, wow, this is amazing. Can I just stay at the hospice home? and unfortunately, while I agree 100%, the hospice home is amazing. Folks can't stay there unless they have they've had a change in level of care to general inpatient. And part of this, you know, has to do with the Medicare rules. So Medicare does not pay anybody, you know, Medicare is a medical benefit. It doesn't pay room and board unless to get the medical care you need, this requires you to be at a medical facility. So, you know, if you're at the hospital, if you have to be in the hospital, Medicare pays your room and board. If you have to be in a skilled nursing facility because you're getting daily physical therapy, like, you have to be there to get your medical treatment. So Medicare pays your room and board. If you're at a skilled nursing facility because you can't take care of yourself and that's where you have to live and you're not getting those extra therapies, then Medicare is not paying, you know, for your room and board in those situations. And so the hospice home it's a similar type situation. So if you have to be in the hospice home because the only way we can, you know, control your pain and nausea is with non-oral medications, then Medicare is going to pay for you to be there. But if you're not getting those things that require you to be where you have 24-hour skilled nursing care, then, you know, Medicare doesn't pay for that. And unfortunately, we don't even have, like, the number of beds for everybody who would like to be in that kind of facility. So we have to prioritize that for the patients who are needing that really high-end aggressive symptom management.
That's very helpful. You mentioned a little bit earlier in this conversation about someone who may not be able to swallow their medications. How do you navigate and ensure a patient's wishes are regarded, considering end of life care, and they're respected, especially if they're unable to communicate those wishes directly? I know that this is something that happens at the hospice home, also in out in the home setting as well. How do you ensure that those wishes are respected?
Again, this, you know, this comes back to conversations and listening to families. Ideally, patients may have had conversations with their families before they got sick. It may be direct as something like, don't put a feeding tube in me, or sometimes it's indirect, like, you know, families recall, oh, wow, you know, mom was really upset when, you know, when grandma had her stroke and couldn't eat and then got a feeding tube and had really poor quality of life for 8 months. That was like, that was really hard on mom. And she said she wouldn't want something like that. But so, you know, sometimes things happen suddenly, before, you know, patients, and families are able to talk about things. So one of, one of the things that, you know, I've asked, you know, families to think about is, you know, you know, your loved one and you've known them for a long time. And if they could, you know, be, you know, sitting up at, you know, at the table with us having this conversation, and their brain was functioning, you know, as it always had, and their true self was, you know, was with us, what would they tell us to do? And so I think having it framed that way allows families to reflect on, you know, what is important to the patient. And a lot of times during this process, it kind of gives them relief when you decide that avoiding suffering is a loving decision. Mm-hmm. Even if that means less time, it doesn't mean less love. It's putting, you know, it's putting what the patient would want at the forefront.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Having those conversations may be a challenge, but being armed with this information really does really help a whole lot. Dr. Emily Carlisle, thank you so much for spending some time on the program today to explain exactly what hospice is, what it isn't, and what we can expect. So, Dr. Carlisle, we really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, it was a great conversation. You can go to transitionslifecare.org if you would like to find more information. If you're looking for some online resources and you have questions, that is a great place to start, transitionslifecare.org. We're out of time for today. On behalf of Mary Lucas and Carson Sellers, I'm Jason Kong. You have been listening to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 92.9, 107.5, and AM 680, WPTF News, Talk, Traffic. Have a great day.
You've been listening to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you on WPTF, AM 680, and WPTF.com. For more information, log on to transitionslifecare.org.